It's April 20th, 2017. It's a Thursday, and it's 8:58 a.m., and I am en route to the high desert for a hike and a tour of some of the back roads and places I might live if, you know, for whatever reason, you know, I just, you know, I end up living out in the middle of nowhere. Because as I drive out there along this Old Woman Springs Road, there are properties in, let's say, Johnson Valley and possibly Lucerne Valley that are 4 or 5 miles off the highway, away far, you know, 5 miles away from the nearest cell tower. And that would be awesome. I'd build a house there, and I'd be willing to live off the grid if that's what it took. These are generally dirt roads, no power, but I'm open to doing that. And so there's some other spots too, east of Lancaster, just in the middle of nowhere, between the 395 and the Antelope Valley Freeway, there's a lot of no man's land. And if I end up getting a good job up there, you know, where I'm paid in today's dollars, you know, in the 90s or the hundreds, which is good pay for me, you know, not good pay for, you know, I read that the average employee, or I don't know what kind of employee it is, but, you know, for Facebook and Google and these other guys, these other technology companies, they're making $182,000 a year on average. And I don't know if that's engineers or if that's management, but there are sectors of the economy where you can certainly make a lot more money than a teacher. But I'm at the high, I'm in the green zone. You know, I spent, most teaching salaries are based on credits above a BA, master's, and then years of service. And most of them max out at pay at 15, 20, 25, 30 years of service. And I'm approaching 30 years of service. And there are a number of employers that offer year-for-year credit, which means I don't have to have those years of service be under that particular organization. They'll just grant me credit onto their pay scale for years of service rendered elsewhere. You know, public, you know, what do you call it? You know, contracted whole year years of service for public schools elsewhere. And so right now, you know, beginning pay for teachers, or let's say 40, and high pay for teachers is 100, 110, I call it 100. And, you know, I'm around, I can get 100 in quite a few places now, or, you know, 95 to 105, just walking in the door. And that's something I couldn't have done the first 10, 15 years of my career. So I'm happy about it. And I have thought about, I think it's one of the more fair, one of the fairest ways to advance teachers is the system we currently have, which is experience in education. Because metrics for evaluation of quality of teaching are in many ways immeasurable. And they can be, you know, in the selection process, some of that can be teased out in a letter of recommendation where your presence, your dedication, your you know, the way your ability to excite and motivate students. You know, it can be in earn the goodwill of parents and all the other people that you work with. You know, it can be stated there in the letter, but it, and so, you know, if there's a competitive application process, and a letter of rec can play a role, but I still believe that the current system of meritocracy based on years of service and education is the best that we is the best plan possible. Because everything else is going to be subject to fraud and nepotism and divisiveness among, you know, it doesn't lead to team building. All right, so I'm going to go up there and take a look now. It was around, I'm going to say that it was around April 5th or so that some new towers or new frequencies and increased field strengths were introduced to not just where I live, but beyond that a bit. I haven't quite assessed it beyond it, but I believe there's a case, it's certainly the case that near where I live, where I'm about a quarter mile away from this tower that was basically not imperceptible, but not threatening. That has gotten way bad now, and it happened right around about a little over 2 weeks ago. And I have been hammered. I've been bedridden. I had green phlegm and pain in my thyroid for like a whole fucking week. It was unbelievable. It was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, I haven't had anything like this before. Not like this. And not the persistent pain in my pineal, pituitary, thyroid, thymus. All at once and all day and all night at the house. You know, to think that I was taking some Advil and these other bullshit over-the-counter pharmaceuticals to reduce fever or swelling or whatever based on some input from some staff. You know, I took it a couple of times and it didn't help. But, you know, the thought was, okay, I'm ill. I got to deal with it. And luckily, you know, the only... I only had about one day where at work where I was obviously impaired, and that was the last day of school before we had before Good Friday, and I had a droopy eye, all glassy eye. At least one of my eyes was all glassy, and it looked like I was under viral attack, and but I was under EMF attack, and the EMFs are perceived as viruses or as threats to my, invaders, things that are very harmful to my body, mind, my health, and and then whether that, the weakening of my immune system in response to the EMF then makes me more, susceptible to actually have bacteria running wild in me. I mean, obviously, you don't get green phlegm from saliva that doesn't have any pathogens in it. So obviously I was under viral and bacterial attack because my defenses were down. But, it's definitely the case that my illness is directly related to the increased ambient EMF, and what was startling to me was how, even though lying on my side, insentient for hours at a time, in the middle of the night, and I would still have great pain in my thyroid and my thymus and in my head. Normally I'm able to assume certain positions that make me less conductive, and or that I would wake up. Normally I wake up in the middle of the night and I feel much calmer because my mind has been turned off and less stressed, in, you know, in a decreased state of distress. And that was not the case for like a good week. It was a new level of impairment and exposure for me. And as I told my mom a couple days ago, the last time that I was broadsided to this extent in my own living situation was when EMFs became absolutely problematic for me in at the end of 1995, when I lived on Oahu. And you know, there, luckily it was during Christmas break, and I you know, spent a week or more, you know, I don't know, living in some guy's greenhouse in, and what's the name of that town, Haula, I think it's on the windward side, closer to North Shore, I think before Laie. And even there it was not good. I could feel certain towers coming on, becoming operational, you know, early in the morning. You know, it was like, do I really want to live in someone's greenhouse? But then I adapted, and you know, there's an adaptation process. I think I'm at least at sort of a semi-plateau right now, where I'm not feeling so threatened, but I'm definitely impaired. I'm not able to think as well now, or, I mean, thought I couldn't think well before. Well, it's dropped off a cliff. But I'm not feeling quite as threatened. And, you know, although last night I wasn't able to go to sleep very well at all. I slept poorly. So it is affecting the quality of my sleep and a whole, everything. But I'm better than I was that first week. So yeah, this is the first time that my personal living circumstances have come under surprising and, you know, like, you know, assault, just out of the blue. And I'm not, in, you know, it's not easy for me to just run away right now. That's why this particular job that I've applied for and I interviewed for, you know, in the high desert, I'm hoping they take me, because then it would allow three things. I mean, one, be closer to my property, close, which is good. Two, allow me to live closer to areas that I can go hiking. So that means, you know, aerobic exercise. And then three, work in a situation that is less toxic electromagnetically. So actually it killed three birds with one stone. Better work environment, better living environment, and more readily available aerobic release. And if it doesn't happen, well, I'm going to, this is the first time since I lived in the volcano subdivision on Oahu, I mean on the Big Island, that's where I moved to initially before I was hired on the Big Island after 6 years of living on Oahu. And I was having all sorts of problems with the EMF in the volcano area. And I mean, I live near the national park, and there's a tower complex and all sorts of stuff up there. It was not healthy, you know? It was brutal. In fact, I remember going on some hikes where I could see the tower array or whatever it was, you know, the antennas, and then I'd be walking behind like a little volcano mountain, and walking in, you know, and then on the other side of it, I could feel a directionality to the EMF and the intensity. I mean, I could feel this stuff coming out of the antennas, and it would stop when I had a physical barrier. But at the house, I didn't have that luxury, and so I think I bought some sheet metal and some other things, and I was trying to lean them up against a wall and in my bedroom, and it's like it just was not working out. I had no idea what I was doing, and you know, it was like living in a rat trap with these panels of metal, and I didn't know how to assemble it properly. And that's when I decided, you know, in the next year or two, I'm going to go visit some shielding manufacturers. And I did. But here I am 20 years later, and I still haven't purchased one. But I think I'm going to embark on that. If I'm stuck where I am right now for another year, I'm now researching some online resources, you know, suppliers for electromagnetic safety. Apparently there are materials that you can, like wallpaper, some carbon-based material that you can put onto walls that not reflect EMF, but absorb it. I'm gonna look at my options, and I'm going to maybe even talk to some consultants. I want to try to create a more safe, if I could reduce the EMF in my bedroom by 80%, I'm good. You know, that's better than it was probably before this new EMF source became known to me 2 weeks ago. And and also it'll be empowering. I have no interest in coexisting with this technology, but if I have to, you know, if I have no other choice, and honestly, where I am right now, where I'm working right now, it's going to be $5,000 or more a year than most of these other places that I'm looking at. So, you know, I'll make the most of it and make a little bit more money. And, try to have an environment that I can live in, that is and work in, that is more conducive to my health. But it will be empowering to explore that. It will also be expensive. I'm looking at I haven't purchased one of these before, an EMF meter, but a really good one. I mean, or some, you know, release a very good consumer model one, you know, in the $500 range, that can give me accurate readings on a variety of frequencies, from the low megahertz up through, I think it says 8 gigahertz. So I'm going to shut out. I'm going to be looking at spending $10,000 or more on adapting that room and seeing what happens. Or my mother has been so kind as to say, you know what, honey, you need to, you know, take over the living room, and maybe I'm going to put an EMF enclosure in there if I can find a modular room that's not too expensive, and have it be shipped to me and then erected in that space, and that will be for sure reducing my exposures. So, yeah, just as, in sum on the, that, this matter is, this is the first time I'm, I have the financial means to do this. And, you know, I'm going to, I may try to defend myself in a very professional manner from the EMF exposures in my neighborhood. You know, not be a victim anymore. Although spending the money on this is victimizing. But my health is important. And, you know, if I need to drop, you know, get rid of some of my investments and, you know, financially, you know, liquidate a few for my health, then so be it. I think this is a worthy cause. And actually, it would be nice to have an objective measure of some of the frequencies I'm exposed to, rather than just, you know, this headache symptoms kind of a deal, you know, that I've relied on. It's not, it's accurate, and it's really the only measure that matters, but, you know, it would help, it would give me more certainty and certainly a quicker read on what exactly I'm being exposed to and how strong. But my body, ultimately the body is the decider. Yeah, and it's the first time that I've faced this since 1995, so 22 years. At least this striking, this, yeah, I could say, oh yeah, things got worse in the cabin I had on in Ojai, California. But you know what? That area was never good. I always saw that as a temporary, you know, I was irritated by the exposures there, and then it just became, I had a truly allergic reaction to it, and then I can no longer hike that Gridley Trail. You know, this is worse right now. And let's see, what's next? The chemically nucleated snowstorm that we had 6 or 8 weeks ago. I mean, we still have snow at the 6 or 7,000 foot level up to 10,000 feet. And it just stays on there like plastic. You listen to Dane Wigington's radio addresses at geoengineeringwatch.org to learn more about this. But nucleated snow, what that means is they can take moisture or precipitation and have it be made into snow at like 50 degrees. And the shit does not melt even in the 50s. I mean, I swear, it's such a slow, I mean, the snow that's up there, it's got to be in the 50s and 60s, and it's still not melting, at least not all the, you know, not all the way. We've had weeks of 90 degree temperatures at sea level, and which means that at 10,000 feet, you're looking at highs in the 50s, and then lower down, you know, 60s, and this has been for weeks. And so I just want to say that the snow that we see atop the San Bernardino Mountains, the San Gabriel Mountains, and the San Jacinto Mountains is fake, and it's got to be like half plastic. You know, it's got this, because it's nucleated snow is famous for a bunch of things. One, occurring at temperatures far above freezing. Two, kind of coagulating on and sticking onto the fur coats of animals, causing like 100,000 head herd die-offs of like llamas and in the Andes, or you know, they've never died from snow before, or, you know, cattle in Texas and other areas, you know, literally 100,000 head dying out of the blue from snow, and it never happens, and that's because it's heavy and it sticks to your hide, and it's an endothermic reaction. You gotta look this stuff up, but it sticks to you and it just freezes and it becomes colder on you because it's a chemical reaction. It's not just light flaky snow dropping down on you. And it also kills hundreds of your 400-year-old trees because it sticks onto the limbs and leaves and it becomes heavy and it just grows and it weighs trees down that have been there for centuries. But it's there as a psychological operation to make us think that, you know, hey, we have cold weather, or you know, this is there's no warming or any problems here, we got snow. But it's really bad, and it's fucking obnoxious to see, you know, persistent 90 degree temperatures, sea level, and snow that just won't melt 7,000, 8,000 feet up. You know, I'm sure the old timers, there's a, in the Wrightwood area, there's a nearly bankrupt ski operation called Mountain High, and they've given up on trying to stick fake snow. I mean, their snow, because they're not using fake snow. You know, you'd look in the mountains and you'd say, hey, you know what? I can go skiing. Well, no, not really. Not at Mountain High, because they have to replenish it with this is only maybe 6,000 to 7,000 feet, and they have to replenish it with real snow, and real snow only stays frozen when you have freezing temperatures. Real snow melts at 35, 40, 45, 50 degrees. I mean, if you got 55 degrees or 60 degrees, as it has been the case for weeks at that altitude, then you know, you're not going to have any, you know, your snow's not going to be there. Your regular snow. So, you know, they might have still some of the nucleated snow there, but they have to supplement it because some of it has melted. But, you know, to add enough of a blanket to actually be able to ski, you can't. And I would love to just have some interviews with the ski operators there that have been there for 20 years or more, and just say, hey, this is, when you see snow on Mountain Baden-Powell or on Mount Williamson or Hawkins Saddle, when you see snow up there like that, doesn't that mean that you've got good conditions for skiing at a little bit of a lower elevation at Mountain High? And they say, absolutely. But not now. Not when you've got fake snow. So that annoys me. It's just a psychological operation. Everyone looks up there and says, wow, it's cold. Well, it's not cold. You know? Just we have, you know, snow that won't melt. I think they had one more thing to say. My health, EMF, fake snow. Yeah, my website. I'll just say that I'm probably going to get a search engine optimization company to help me out a bit. And really what it is I just need to tease out how I'm being buried by Google. I've got a page that's got 100 or so CD album art covers that I've scanned, and none of those images come up in the Google database, and Because what I like to do is I troll the web. You know, someone who's not looking for Kundalini and cell towers as far as concepts. I have a lot of other content and images at my site that hopefully people will click on and get what they want, but then, you know, maybe 5% of them might take a gander at the rest of my site, and it will be eye-opening to them. And so I do like to, and I'm not getting any of that sort of corollary or tertiary or secondary traffic like I used to. Almost nothing. I get now 1 to 2 referrals a day from search engines, mostly Google. I call it 1 a day, 1.5 a day, whereas I used to get 500 a day. And I know that alternative media is under attack, but it's certainly gotten worse for me. But it's dropped off a cliff in the last 4 months. But it's been under sustained attack for a year or more. And I just want someone to tell me that that's what's going on, and how can I want more search engine referrals. Because a lot of my, if you're looking for, let's say, a good scan of, say, music, television, you know, MTV, Party to Go, 1999, or whatever it is, you know, I've got a bunch of stuff there, and it's just not, you can't find my site via a Google search, or my content. It's messed up. It's depressing. And I know that Google has demonetized. You know, if you're not uploading pro Clinton, pro Black Lives Matter, pro war, pro, you know, funny cat videos all day long at YouTube, you know, where if you're doing that, you can earn a good living at YouTube because you get paid based on views. Because they're making money selling people's data and throwing ads on and there and whatnot. But if you have alternative views on just about anything that's counter to the mainstream media, the corporate media agenda, you're being demonetized and or delisted or buried in search results. You know, that is, you know, buried in, you know, the algorithm will push you back a whole long ways, and that's a form of censorship. You know, instead of being exposing my thoughts to 100 people a day, it's probably like one person a day, and it makes me feel impotent, and it makes me feel like my time is well spent when I'm working on content for my site. It really depresses me. It was thrilling back in 2003, 2004, 2005 when I, you know, my content was up and ranked around 900,000 internationally. Whereas right now, if you can believe Alexa, and I don't, it says it's ranked like 3 million something. But given the paucity of traffic and how most of the referrals are it looks all fake, all spammy stuff. I don't get there's nothing legit going on in terms of traffic to my site. I think all my traffic is fake. I don't think I get any real eyeballs. I mean, hardly any. But I want to do some research into that. Find out if there's anything that I can do, you know, because I know that some people have challenged Google, you know, like Mike Adams, the health ranger of naturalnews.com, and you know, if you have a big platform, you can create a fuss, and then Google backs off, or at least says they are, even though I doubt that they do fully. But I don't have that kind of leverage. So I, you know, going forward, and when I have a chance, I do want to research. Pay an ex-Google employee. You know, tell me what's really going on. Why is my traffic so fucked up? Why do I get no exposure? You know, I want my argument to be heard by more people. And I think that's about it for right now. Over and out.